I want to welcome everybody to my fourth Tuesday Revolutionize Your Retirement Interview with Experts series. I'm Dori Mintzer, owner of Revolutionize Retirement and your facilitator today. And we're in for a wonderful presentation from a friend and colleague, Barbara Greenspan-Shaman, who I'm going to tell you about in just a few minutes. But I want to just mention a few of the housekeeping details first. First of all, there are no slides, so nobody has to worry about seeing slides. There is a handout on the event page, which is Barbara's legacy profile. So if you haven't already seen it, you'll be able to see it and download it if you want when you get the recording link. Everybody who has signed up will get a link for the recording after the call. So I know sometimes people sign up and they're not able to be here live. So everybody will get a recording, and Barbara will also get a recording that you can use in whatever way you'd like to on your website or however you'd like to use it. If you're on the phone and the computer, my recommendation is put the volume down on the computer so you don't end up having an echo. So that would be one thing to keep in mind. And also, the only way on this call that questions and comments can be made is if you go to the event page, and you'll see on the left-hand side there's a place where you can do comments or questions. And Barbara has generously agreed to offer her book, Live Your Legacy Now, 10 Simple Steps to Find Your Passion and Change the World. She's going to give a copy of that book to the best question as judged by me. I always have a little struggle with that, but hopefully it will inspire people to submit your questions, and one of you will be the lucky winner. And when you hear at the end, and I'll remind people then too, that you have won the book, send me an email, dorian@dorianmintzer.com, with your name and your address, and then I'll get that to Barbara, and we'll be able to she'll be able to send the book to you. So, without further ado, I want to introduce Barbara to you. She is a noted educator, businesswoman, and social entrepreneur, and she's used her skills and ability to empower others to create social change. In 1995, she founded Champions of Caring, which is a nonprofit organization that has empowered over 10,000 youth in Philadelphia and South Africa to become leaders in public service and active, engaged citizens. She's created programs that have inspired and motivated young people with the skills to create service projects to address local and global issues and create cultures of caring within their own schools and communities. From the success of Champions of Caring with young people, she's combined her professional experience, entrepreneurial spirit, and over 30 years of public speaking, and that led her to create Embrace Your Legacy, and her website is embraceyourlegacynow.com. She's written two books, Live Your Legacy Now, 10 Simple Steps to Find Your Passion and Change the World, and Live Your Legacy Now, My Legacy Portfolio, which shares her message and encourages adults of all ages and backgrounds to learn and live their legacies. We're going to learn about her background during the call, and as you'll hear, part of her life experience has really motivated her to be very involved in living one's legacy now and setting up programs. And you also, through her speeches, workshops, and consulting, she shares her approach to provide participants with the necessary tools to create social change in an informed and creative way. She's presented this message to audiences of all ages and backgrounds, locally, nationally, and internationally, and especially enjoys bringing multiple generations together to inspire and teach them how to convert their values and interests into actions that are meaningful and rewarding. And I know that Barbara wants all of you to know, too, that if you have a situation, and she'll be mentioning it, too, she's open for speaking opportunities and really welcomes the opportunity to continue to share her words of wisdom to everybody around the globe, really. So, Barbara, I'm glad to have you here. We met at a positive aging conference somewhere along the line and through the Life Planning Network. And one of the joys that I have with doing this series is I get to just have more time with people. So, you know, Barbara and I, you know, spent some time talking about the call. And, I mean, that's sort of the joy that I get from it. And now you're all going to have the joy of being able to listen to Barbara. So, welcome, and I'm so glad you're with us. And maybe we could start, if it's okay with you, of how your family history inspired and empowered you. Let's just start with that, because I consciously chose not to mention that in my introduction, because I want, you know, and we're going to be kind of going back and forth and just talking throughout the call, but maybe we could start with that and, you know, your background and the key lessons you learned from the background that you've had?
Sure. Well, first of all, Dori, it is such a pleasure to be on the call. And when I met you, I think it was 5 years ago in Sarasota at a positive aging meeting, we just clicked immediately. And then I saw you in Boston at a Life Planning Network meeting. And I'm very grateful that you were giving me the privilege of sharing my passions and interests with your audience today. My background has clearly shaped who I am as a person. My mother was the sole survivor of a family of 65 people. She was from Lodz, Poland, and unfortunately, she fortunately survived, but unfortunately had to go through a lot of horror at the age of 15 when she was initially put into the Lodz ghetto, then from that went on to Auschwitz, then to Stutthof, and finally was liberated in Theresienstadt. But what was so extraordinary about my mother and what she shared with me throughout her life was that in each situation, no matter how horrific it was, she tried to find her own humanity. When she was put into the Lodz ghetto, she said to me, she was already 15 years old and had been fortunate enough to live a good chunk of her life. These are her words. And she saw these young children, 3-month-olds, 2-year-olds, 4-years-old, just roaming around the ghetto aimlessly, and she took it upon herself each day to find these young kids, to tell them stories, to sing to them, to try to give them some kind of comfort, because she didn't understand exactly what was happening, but she knew that all of their lives were unraveling. And I when my mother died about 5 years ago of dementia, one of the last things she said to me was, "If I go, who will take care of the children?" You see, Dori, this had made such an incredible impression on her life that it was so important to take care of helpless people that she took that to her deathbed. And I knew what she was referring to, and I looked at her and I said, "Don't worry, Mom, I will do that." And her face lit up with joy. So even out of this horrific time in her life, she saw her need to tap into her humanity, or as she would put it, to be a real mensch. I frequently had asked my mother, "How did you survive in a place like Auschwitz?" And her comment to me was, "Fantasy." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I would fantasize about holidays with my own family and remember those wonderful times and then project into the future and think, if I'm fortunate enough to survive, I will recreate these incredible experiences." And the comment which resonated with me throughout her life and now continues on a daily basis to inspire me was, "The sun came out for me even after Auschwitz. Always have hope because it can always come out for you." And that's what I really want to share today, the resiliency that my mother taught me, and it's encapsulated in that quote, that yes, life can have very dark moments and can be very, very challenging, but there's always hope, and to be strong and courageous, that life can be better. And I think this teaching about resiliency and not victimization, she never bemoaned the fact that she was victimized during the Holocaust, but rather focused on how she came out strong, hopeful, and the lessons she learned, which she transmitted to me, where there's hate, give love. Where there's negativity, be positive. and that we need to constantly be vigilant and create a society that is kind and good and compassionate. And this kind of social activism really resonated for me throughout my entire life. My father worked for Oskar Schindler, and this was very, very good for him in that he had a place to go every day. He had food, he had clothing, but unfortunately he was not on the famous list and instead was put on the death march. And while on that death march, he was with his cousin who was very ill with typhus, and my father carried him most of the way in the freezing, brutal winter snow, because had he not carried his cousin Henry, he would have fallen in the snow and died. And he said to me, even on a death march, you can be a mensch. My grandmother was in Auschwitz, and she found berries growing on the ground, and when she crushed them, she saw they made a rouge-like substance. So every morning before the appel, where they counted all of the prisoners to see who died and who was still alive, my grandmother would get up an hour earlier and begin to rouge the cheeks of the frail elderly women in the barrack so that they could live another day. So this message of helping people, of trying to do your best even under the worst of circumstances, really shaped the way I saw the world from a very, very young age. I was born in Germany after the war, came to New York City in the early 50s, and always saw philanthropy. When my father was making $50 a week, a few of those dollars, 5 or 10, went to Oskar Schindler out of gratitude for what he did to support my father. And he had a whole group of Schindler Jews, and they all helped support and take care of Oskar Schindler until he died. So I saw this level of giving. I saw that there's always space to share, even if you have very little. If someone lost their job, my father would come home and say to my mother, get the women to start cooking and bring meals over to that house. We have to help. So this notion of philanthropy in even the most modest fashion, but always thinking about what can I do to help someone, to give someone a more positive outlook on their lives, was instilled in me at a very early age. And the knowledge that, yes, you can make a difference. Sometimes people feel, why should I vote or why should I do that? It's only me. But I think this ripple effect of each of us trying to do something to make the world a better place is really important. And especially in today's political climate, I think we have an extraordinary opportunity to stand up, speak out, and look at issues that really are relevant to us and have our voices heard. And I think one of the best things that I'm seeing around me now is the social activism that has happened because of this administration and their policies. So this is a lesson that I've carried throughout my life, and know that my mother used to say, the more you give, the more you get. And I know that my heart is filled with joy the more I can reach out and help someone else, because in doing that, I think you really tap into your soul and your own humanity. So this background really shaped me to think about social justice and about what place do I have in this world and how can I improve things around me that are meaningful to me. And I think, Dory, the word meaningful, I mean, some issues might not have as much relevance to your listeners as others, but when you find something that really touches your heart and you care about, that's, for me, a moment to think about how can I address this issue. So this background really gave me the strength, the resiliency, the courage, and the creativity to know that I can do something. And what's the worst thing that can happen? It doesn't go that well. But, you know, you try. And you put yourself, if you surround yourself with like-minded people who are willing to take the risk to address an important issue.
Oh, so inspiring, Barbara. I mean, I've heard you tell this and talked with you about it before, but I must say, I mean, you really are this breathing, living role model of living your legacy and the legacy that's been passed on to you. Your parents, just, and grandmother, your family, and the experiences, but what you've learned and what they've what they've shown and said, you know, during their lives is just amazing. I wish that this could reach everybody in the globe. Our world would be a very different place if people could hear some of what you're saying. So what, you know, when you were growing up, what were some of the dreams and aspirations that you had? And how did, you know, cause clearly the legacy and I just wish I had been able to, I guess I meet your mother and father and grandmother through you. I just feel the palpableness of that. But tell us a little about your dreams and aspirations growing up and, you know, and how you began to kind of live those dreams, because I know you have spent most of your life doing that.
Well, it's interesting. I'm a baby boomer, and when I was going to Hunter College in the 60s, there weren't that many opportunities for women that are available today. And I didn't dream in Technicolor the way I've been able to dream, let's say, in the 80s and 90s and 2000. But I always had dreams of being a teacher because my mother loved youth so much. And I think her experience in the Lodz ghetto really inspired me, because she used to say, if you change a child's life, you change the world forever. So initially, I went into the field of education and wrote curriculum for at-risk students in Title I programs. These were kids who scored very low in math and English skill sets, and I enjoyed the creativity. And it's interesting, I've always had a feeling for multiple generations. And one of the things that I did, which really touches me to this day, I didn't know how the influence of this would change a kid's life, was I would take these young people. I was living in the Berkshires in Pittsfield, Massachusetts at the time, and I would take these at-risk kids into the senior centers. Many of them did not have significant people in their lives. Some barely knew their parents. They were in jails. They were living at friends' homes, and they bonded so much with these seniors. And I knew from my own relationship, because I shared a room with my grandmother till I was 19 years old, how important that multiple generational impact can be on a young person's life. And I used to dream about, can I do this for young children? And that was my first dream to come to fruition, working with kids, putting significant adults into their lives. And I'm talking now about the 70s. I really saw the importance of having multiple generations interact with each other. And it's interesting, because now I see that as even one of the most important things that in the work that I do, in terms of bringing together multiple generations and respecting the voices of the people sitting around the table. And within a family system particularly, I'm very blessed to have children and grandchildren, and being able to pull them into conversations and hear their voices and hear what their views are on the world. Because what I've discovered is that sometimes the most interesting ideas emanate from a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, what they want to address and how they would like to view the world and their place in the world. So I think a lot of that goes back to the relationship I had with both my parents and my grandmother, and living in this multi-generational world and hearing different points of views. You asked me about dreaming. My dreams got stronger and stronger as the women's movement progressed, because more and more opportunities were available to women. I was also married to an executive, and we moved every 3 or 4 years, and I was able to reinvent myself. So I never dreamt that I would do more than one thing in my life. I candidly thought that I would live across the street from my mom in New York City and be a teacher. And as my life unfolded, I kept moving every 3 and 4 years, and with each move, I reinvented myself. And I went from being a curriculum writer and educator into the world, and this is funny, of selling ice cream, marketing Häagen-Dazs and Ben & Jerry's ice cream. and reaping the rewards of getting Wegmans to be one of my biggest accounts when I was trying to sell ice cream to a man who was the head of Frozen Foods who hated ice cream. And that was a coup to be able to convince him that he should try this ice cream. And I got his secretary to taste it and tell him that it was really good. And I was able to get these 65 stores. So I thought, wow, if I can sell ice cream to someone who doesn't like ice cream, I bet I could do other things. And from there, I went on to get involved in the executive search world was a partner in a national firm and then created my own executive search firm. All things that I never thought I could have dreamt of when I was 16-year-old. And it was a combination of the women's movement empowering women to have more choices and my being a risk taker. And you know who was my biggest advocate always? Always saying to me, go ahead, you want to try your own firm, do it. It was my mom, who was, her education was truncated at the age of 15, but through her children and then her grandchildren, she always gave us faith and hope in ourselves. Come on, try it. What's the worst that can happen, she used to say. Try it, try it, try it. And I was running a national executive search firm when I was in my early 40s and never, ever thought that as a woman I could run a company. So it was the inspiration that my mother gave me to believe in myself that took those dreams, which initially were smaller, and then as I had more and more experiences of success in the business world, I realized that I could be a guarded risk taker. And I made mistakes across the way, but you learn from those mistakes. There was a very interesting article in the New York Times this Sunday about the importance of learning failure and how schools are teaching, colleges are teaching about how do you deal with failure. So I learned as much and more from the failures that I've had in business than from the growth that I've had. But I took a turn and realized that I didn't want to stay in the for-profit sector and was actually interested in moving into the not-for-profit sector. And that was the genesis of Champions of Caring.
Right. We'll get to that in just a moment, but I'm just so impressed with just thinking about legacy and, you know, what carries from generation to generation and the legacy that your family gave you in their risk-taking, which really is what kept them alive. And the, you know, just thinking about the pattern that you've talked about of the intergenerational or caring for other people, just the ways that both your father caring his cousin and, you know, your grandmother and the berries and the, putting rouge on the elderly and your mother looking out for the children. I mean, it just feels like it's sort of part of your DNA that's evolved. And it's such a beautiful example of how the survival instinct, the resilience, the risk-taking, it's like paying it forward, which is what, you know, certainly through your life and work, you know, through and the shifting from the for-profit to not-for-profit shows all of us. I mean, it's just very inspiring. So, yeah, so let's move into the champions. Tell us about the champions of caring and what inspired you to create it and how did it all come about?
Well, it was 1999, and I was frankly in shock that I was running this national company that recruited senior-level healthcare executives and physicians and loved it. I didn't know if I could ever do something like this. It was beyond my aspirations for myself, and I found that I enjoyed the work. It's not easy work because people change their minds all the time, and you have to balance your clients' needs with your candidates' needs. But I really did love the work, and it was a lucrative position to be in. And then in 1999, there was an annual gathering of Holocaust survivors here in Philadelphia. And my mother, my brother, my father, and I were marching to the Liberty Bell. Now, my mother always said to my brother and me, I never want you to go back to Poland or Germany. Horrible things happened to us there. Don't go there. And we sort of accepted that. If that was her wish, we didn't want not to abide by it. And all of a sudden, she looks at us and says, I've had a change of heart. I think we should all go back to Poland. And I want to tell my story, and I want Dad to tell his story, and I'd like you to videotape it. Steven Spielberg had not started the Shoah Foundation, which is where he took monies to interview all over the world Holocaust survivors and to archive their testimonies, which is an extraordinary thing that he's done. This was 1999, and my brother's a physician, and he initially felt this was a terrible thing to do for them, that it would be too traumatic, and tried to talk my mother out of it. But my mother was determined and strong, and she said, no, this is something we need to do. We're healthy. We're able to do this now. Let's do it. And Dori, I couldn't believe it. She mobilized 100 Holocaust survivors and their children in the New York area to be part of this trip. Well, we went to Poland, and I could speak for a very long time about what happened on that trip, but I'd like to focus on the day we went to Auschwitz. I was a wreck. I was so frightened to walk in the steps that my mother and paternal grandmother took when they were incarcerated in Birkenau. And it was a terrible, terrible morning for me. I was shaky. I just was afraid to see my mother's face as she walked us through this horror. And I have to share a quick story. My mother used to brush her teeth constantly. We were always late for everything because she'd always say, oh, I have to brush my teeth one more time. And in dementia, she would wake up her caretaker in the middle of the night to brush her teeth. And we just sort of made fun of her sometimes. We got angry with her sometimes. We never understood why. We were walking through Auschwitz, and my mother turns to me and said, I was 19 years old. I had lost my entire family. I had lost every worldly possession. I snuck a toothbrush into Auschwitz in my dress, and they took it from me. It was the last vestige of my humanity. Well, Dori, I was so shaken. I was mortified. I felt sick to my stomach. I looked at her and I said, Mom, I have to go out and get a breath of fresh air. I'll be back in a minute. And I started sobbing. I was a wreck because I didn't realize that this toothbrush was the only worldly possession she had as a 19-year-old. And while I was standing in the courtyard, there were a group of young people, about 15, 16, 17-year-olds, laughing and clowning around. And I felt indignant. How can you do that at Auschwitz? This is a killing place. How can you clown around like that? So I approached them, and I heard they were speaking German, and I speak German. That was my first language. And I said to them, how are you behaving? What are you thinking? What are you doing? And they started laughing at me. And in that moment, my entire life changed because I had this epiphany that instead of recruiting physicians, I needed to help young people understand compassion and kindness and respect. And this name, Champions of Caring, came to me that what if I could take all the skills I had learned in business and apply them in a not-for-profit world? What if I could create a program that promoted social activism, promoted pro-social behaviors, celebrated young people for exemplifying these kinds of skill sets? And if I could train teachers, I had the education background. That was my major. I had been in education for the first part of my career, and I decided this is what I'm going to do. And when I came back, I remembered starting to tell people that this was my vision, and they thought that I had lost it. They were telling me that I should really breathe deeply and you know, take a break. But I knew that I was going to be determined that this was going to be the next stage of reinvention in my life. And I was very fortunate that my best friend's husband at the time was the CEO of NBC Television. And I approached him with my vision, and he approached Steven Spielberg and put me in touch with him. And Steven Spielberg, through his Righteous Persons Foundation, was gracious enough to give me my first grant to begin something that I called Champions of Caring. And for 22 years, I was blessed to touch lives of thousands of young people here in Philadelphia, by training their teachers to create a culture of caring in a classroom. Because truly, it's all about living cultures of caring in schools, in home, in the community, in the faith-based community. If people could just care and respect each other, it would be such a different world. And I was blessed to surround myself with wonderful, committed board members and staff people. And we went into the most persistently dangerous schools here in Philadelphia because the superintendent said to me, I love what you're doing, but I'm sending you to the toughest schools. And I took that on as a challenge. Some of the schools, in 1 year, one of these schools had 7 kids murdered in that school. And I worked hard with that faculty to help create a culture of kindness in that building. And then we gave young people toolkits to create projects for social change. And that's what I'm particularly proud of. What came from young people who had so little in their lives. Many were couch surfers. I didn't even know what that meant. It means that they don't have a home, but they sleep on different people's couches. Mm-hmm. Many of them were abused. Many of them were very pessimistic about their lives. And in finding something in their own hearts that they could give back to society, it changed them. And I would love to just share a quick story that exemplifies what I'm talking about, if I may. When I worked with youth, and I was very hands-on in the program because I love young people. I love their energy, their passion, and their desire to change things. I would always start sessions, and what we would do is Drexel University was our partner, and we would bring in kids from very different worlds. We brought in African-American and white kids, Jews, Muslims, Christians, the wealthiest and the poorest, because I felt if we brought in disparate groups of young people, they would learn from each other and learn to respect each other, because there weren't many opportunities for kids to mingle from such different areas in the community. And I would always start a session with, what are you passionate about? What do you love? What really excites you? And as I say this, I would like your listeners to think about answering that question in their own minds, because we'll focus more on it later. And I remember having this young man, he was 15, his name was Raul, and he raised his hand with so much joy, and he said, I love salsa dancing. And I said, that is terrific. And he told me that this gives him great joy, and his aunt is a great salsa dancer, and he likes to dance with her. And then my second question, what is something that makes you angry? What makes you so angry that you want to scream sometimes? And he raises his hand and he says, old white people who, when they see African-American and Latino boys like me, they cross the street, they don't want to make eye contact, they don't want to deal with me because they're prejudiced against me and they don't even know me. I looked at him and I said, Raul, what if you could combine your love of salsa and this anger about this prejudice? Do you think that could possibly work? And he said to me, you know, all those old people go into this senior center right near my school. What if I went in there and I taught them the salsa? And I said, that's great, Raul. I said, but you know what? I want to teach you a word today. And the word is impact. It means that sometimes in life you can do something one time and it's really great and you've made a difference and it's nice, but if you really want to change something in a big way, you might want to think about, can you do this as more of a project? And I took out this toolkit that a bunch of educators and I had put together, and I showed it to him. And basically it looked at, what is your mission statement? What are your goals? What are your objectives? Who do you need on your team? Do you need a budget? How will you assess if this is working? I mean, these are tools that I used to use in my business life, and they were so applicable here. And his body language at first was, oh, my God, lady, you're killing me. I could see he was scared and overwhelmed. I said, let me find a teacher or a guidance counselor in your high school to help you with this. Would you want to try it? He said, well, if someone can really help me do it, yes. Because I wanted them to understand that you can really create social change in an impactful and sustainable way. And if I gave them these tools and helped them understand the parts of the whole project, that they could really create something that they would be proud of. Well, Raul found the guidance counselor, and the first thing they did was write their mission statement and goals, and they sent a letter to both the principal of his high school and to the senior center director explaining why he wants to go in there and change attitudes in that community in Philadelphia. The next thing, he recruited 20 African American and Latino boys. This really sings to my heart because, frankly, most of the projects we really got involved with, there were many more young women involved than men. So for Raul to bring in all these young men was truly exemplary. They taught each other how to teach the salsa because they understood that teaching and dancing are two different skill sets. And then they wrote the letter and asked for a date, and they went in and they taught these 70, 80, and 90-year-olds the salsa. He called me up and said it was the best day ever because not only did the seniors love the salsa, they taught him this old fogey dance called the jitterbug. And they bonded, and it really started something very special. In this toolkit that I gave Raul, there was a lesson on how to do an oral history project. And Raul and these 20 young men started writing down these questions. Were you ever bullied? How did you feel about it? Did you ever bully someone else? Do you think people get bullied now? And they went into the senior center with the audiovisual teacher, and they videotaped segments of what they were doing with this oral history project with the seniors. And then they did something they never thought they could do. They stood up in front of 1,000 of their classmates and talked about how they're changing attitudes in this part of Philadelphia, and that it's important not to be prejudiced and to be open-minded. These are things they never would have done before the project. The organization skills they learned, the presentation skills, the writing skills. It was just amazing how these young boys blossomed. They then went to Home Depot using my 501c3 stationery and got free paint and brushes, and they cleaned up the senior center. Every year, Drexel gave us a $50,000 scholarship for one of our students, and we would have this wonderful celebration of the young people and what they did. And this particular year, Raul and this 82-year-old woman, Miss Jane, get up on a stage in front of hundreds of people and start dancing the salsa. And she says to the audience after the dance, you know, before I met Raul, I had hate in my heart, and I never knew that. They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, this 15-year-old changed my life forever. And I love this story because it so exemplifies how a young person can take their passion and their anger, combine it to create a legacy project, and change lives. Sitting in the audience at a meeting that we had, processing what happened with Raul's project, was a young girl, Maddie. And Maddie came from a very affluent mainline family. And she turns to Raul and says, Raul, you blew me away. You are so awesome. And I've been thinking about what Barbara says about passion. And I'm passionate about fashion. I love clothes. I love buying them. I love wearing them. And I love designing them. And recently, we had someone come in and talk about genocide in Africa and what happened in Darfur and in different parts of Africa. And I thought to myself, just because I live in Philadelphia doesn't mean I can't do something about Africa. And I found there was a website called Save Darfur Foundation. So I am going to take my passion for fashion and my anger about genocide in Africa and raise money. And I love this story because she took the project globally. But the best part of the story about Maddie, and this is what I want to underscore for all of your listeners, is that her family became so enamored of her project that they took it on as a family mission. And her grandparents and parents got involved. They helped her create a website. They gave her money to create more T-shirt designs. And Maddie and her family did this all through high school and all through college. And I've lost touch with her now because they might still be doing this. And the reason I love to share these two stories is the one about Maddie particularly, because the best ideas sometimes come from young people. So I encourage your listeners to include multiple generations in discussions about what's a project we can do, what's something of importance to us as a family, and listen to the ideas of young people. Too frequently we dismiss them or don't even ask them for the idea, and it's a very matriarchal or patriarchal approach. This is what our family does. This is how we do it. And frequently we turn off people. I now deal with some very high net worth people, and they can't understand why they cannot get their children and grandchildren involved in their projects. The operative word is there. It should be our projects. So listening to the voices of everyone at the table is important. And for shorthand, I'd like to say to your listeners, as you hear these stories, what's your salsa? What excites you? What gives you joy? What ignites your passion and makes you want to address something? And that's the formula that I learned in working with young people. What do they love and what upsets them? And how can they marry these two concepts to live a legacy and to live it now? When I was growing up, the word legacy was something that you only associated with queens and kings and royalty and billionaires. But the truth is, each of us lives a legacy. And for me, it's not just what I leave when I'm gone, but rather how I model my values, how I put them into action, how I live my life on a daily basis. I found a quote, Dori, that I want to share. It says, life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. So what is my challenge every day? To create myself and do things that give me the meaning and purpose that so enriches my life. So Champions of Caring was a huge turning point in my life because I never thought I could impact more than 5 or 10 young people. But with the help of so many people in this community, dear friends and colleagues, we were able to not only work with 10,000 kids here, but we started a pilot. I went to South Africa and started a pilot in Cape Town, where we had young people in Philadelphia and young people in Cape Town working to create solutions for issues in their own communities. So I went from dreaming more in black and white to dreaming in technicolor, but you always need to have a plan and really approach it, I think, almost with a business model, goals, objectives, mission, and constantly assessing what's working and what's not working. And one of the things that I propose to people is creating legacy groups, that if you can come together and come up with an idea that resonates with the group and meet and create these projects for social change and have the vision and the mission and the goals, you can really make tremendous change happen. It never dawned on me that we could touch so many lives. But with wonderful people around me and a lot of determination and drive to do the work, miracles can happen.
Well, you certainly are giving us examples of many, many miracles. And the other part that hits me is, you know, you were talking about, you know, moving so much and reinventing your life. And in so many ways, you're taking that skill that you developed and you're helping these kids, as well as the intergenerational programs, you're helping people reinvent their life and find themselves. I mean, it's just very wonderful. I mean, it really is so impressive.
You know, Dori, they're saying with millennials, they're going to change careers every 7 years.
Right.
This is what some of the data
right.
is telling us. I did that myself, not by design, but because we kept moving so much, and I had to figure out, so who can I be while I live in Syracuse, New York, or Daytona Beach, Florida, or Pittsfield, Massachusetts, or Schenectady, New York? I mean, these are some of the locations that I found myself in, and I had to do an assessment of what are my strengths, what are the skills that I like to use, how can I take what I've learned from previous positions and utilize them in a different environment. I know frequently we think we are X. I am a teacher, I am this, I am that. I have learned throughout my career that I take the skills with me and they're applicable in the for-profit sector, in the not-for-profit sector, in writing a book and giving a speech, that we hone those skills. But the secret for me, I think, as I'm getting older, is trying to just keep using the skills and doing things that I enjoy and getting away from the onerous pieces of work like grant writing and constantly soliciting people for money. These were things I had to do for many, many years, especially when I was running Champions of Caring. They were not my favorite things, and but you have to do what you have to do. But as I assess who am I today and what do I want in my own life, I want to keep taking the skills that I think I'm good at and trying to utilize them in different settings. And I'm loving my work now with Embrace Your Legacy, because on any given day I could be speaking to high school students, or I could be at a senior center speaking to people in their 80s and 90s, or to groups of women or men, or in the faith-based community, or doing something I just did that I loved, where there were, through this was through the Philadelphia Foundation here, where I had 60, 70, and 80-year-old mothers and their daughters working in a workshop to figure out what their legacy is. And I love that multi-generational approach, and I'm looking to do much more of that. I'm doing something in Florida this winter where we have young people that are 14, 15-year-olds and their parents and their grandparents coming into some of these sessions. And I think that could be a really interesting dialogue to really start to inculcate these values of giving back in young children. Because I, you know this term affluenza, where if you don't pass on your money with your values, the next generation can blow all that wealth very quickly because the values are not there. So passing on those values and being active about it. I mean, I'm very proud. My daughter started things with her children at very young ages. At the holiday time, we get these lists of kids and their wish lists. They might be in the juvenile justice system or having problems, but we come together as a family, put in money, and we go shopping for their wish list. And this started when my granddaughter was about 7 or 8, and it's a project that she loves and every year looks forward to, getting people's wish lists so that they can get a gift at holiday time. There's so many ways to do this with young children, and I love to talk about that as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. We'll get to that in a moment. I just want to encourage people to send in questions or comments. There's one that's been here for a while, and I think it relates, and I think you partly responded to it, but I just think it kind of fits here, Barbara. So Pat from Ormond says, how do I start to become me? Lack of confidence and fear are crippling, but I know there's more to me. So how do I start to be able to, I mean, I think the rest of the sentence is to start living my legacy now. And do you want to, I mean, you said some of it, but it might be able to expand on that.
You know, I would say that, you know, I understand the fear, because sometimes fear can paralyze us or we don't have enough confidence to try it. There are several pieces to the response to that. One is, what do you care about? What do you love? You know, it's what's your salsa. If you can identify something that you really love, that will really give you the incentive to use it. And I also believe that in not being an island, I like to surround myself with people that are positive and forward-thinking. Many of the things that I've come up in my life, I've always had a group of people that I've bounced my ideas off of. So if you have a group of friends and you can share this, don't do it on your own. Do it with a group of people. I know I was once giving a talk and there were 5 women who came to hear the talk, and they lunch once a month. They go to lunch. And they came up to me after my lecture and they said, you know what, instead of just going to lunch from now on, we're going to create a little legacy group and start talking amongst ourselves about what our salsa is. What do we love? What are we passionate about? And what's something in society that we'd like to address either locally or globally? And I think that was the secret, that they had each other to fall back on. So you don't see this is just me alone trying to figure this out. But you bring people into your life to bounce ideas off of and create something that you have support. So it's not all on you. I know for me, always having people around me who are not naysayers. I don't like the naysayers. I want constructive criticism, but not people who always say, oh, you'll never be able to do that, or that could never happen. You want people who are positive and upbeat to look at, what am I passionate about? What do I care about? What's an issue that's important to me? Can I investigate? Who's already doing it? You don't have to create a 501c3. You can look at the organizations that are already addressing an issue. Can you join their board? Can you be part of what they're doing? Can you bring an idea to this community that they might not have tried yet? I mean, I would say to people, don't jump into a 501c3. It's very complicated unless you have the time and the expertise and the people around you. Believe me, when I started this organization, I had no clue what I was really getting into by running a 501c3. It's a lot of work. You need legal advice, accounting advice. You need a lot of people around you. But you start small, and then you can build on it. And if you find that you're very passionate about an issue and it should evolve into a 501c3, go for it. But I would always start on a smaller scale with people that I trust and will be supportive to me, and try it. But first do your due diligence. See who's already addressing this issue, what they're doing. Can you join forces with them? Can you bring another perspective to the issue? So that would be my best advice. But start with something. Reach out to a friend.
That's great. And that ties into Annie from Concord said that she's just found this whole discussion very rich and inspiring. And she says she loves exactly what you've done and has a similar career background and skills, has worked with adults and seniors and has loved it. The dilemma, she says, is I'm 70 and the idea of starting something like her program from scratch is too daunting. And I think you just responded to it, but can she recommend a way to get involved with a program similar to hers to contribute without being the originator? So how would somebody, you know, go about finding some of the similar programs to, like, your program?
Well, if you Google it, you know, there's a new word called Google. It says it all.
That's true.
If you do your research, there are so many organizations. Bill Clinton has a website where he lists all the kinds of organizations and the different issues that they address. This is all so available, and you can do it within your own region and your own community. Find out what's going on in the field that you care about. See who's doing what. And truly, it's all available on the internet. And then make a few calls. Go out to for coffee with someone. See what they're involved with. See if you like the culture of the organization. You know, when you have that meeting, do you like the person? Are you comfortable with the way they're presenting what they're doing? Go to one of their meetings. People are always looking for interesting and interested people who want to move an agenda around social justice. So, you know, I'm finding for myself right now, I'm also looking to take my skills for right now, like the issue of immigrants is an important issue to me. I was an immigrant. I don't like what I'm seeing about what's going on with immigrants in this country. So I'm reaching out to organizations that deal with immigrants to see if I can adopt a family or somehow be helpful to immigrants in this community, because I sort of remember, I mean, I was only 4 or 5 years old when I came to this country, but it's hard. It is so hard to be an immigrant in a new country. So you look at what are you interested in, who is doing that in your community, and make a phone call and see if you can come and talk to them and see what it's about, or get a group of friends together and have a brainstorming session and do your due diligence and look at what's out there and see what resonates for you. Absolutely, you don't have to start a 501c3. Join existing organizations that, A, have a mission that resonates for you and that there's a culture in the organization that you're comfortable with. And I stress that point because I've been on boards, and I'm a very out-of-the-box creative thinker, and some people don't like that. They think it's too radical. And I appreciate that. That's not a problem. But I shouldn't sit on that kind of a board because my ideas are not welcome and I'm not taking them to the next steps that they need. So I've resigned from boards over the years because I've not felt that it was a right fit. So it's a little bit of a dress rehearsal, if you will, meeting the people, seeing what they sound like, what their vision is, what they're thinking, and seeing if it's a good fit. It's the match.com for service.
Yep. Yeah, no, it really is. Cullen from Hawaii, from Honolulu asks, he says, pre-retirees and active retirees are often interested in remaining fit, physical, financial, social, nutritional, etc. Do you see this discussion of legacy as primary before even addressing those other issues of, quote, fitness?
No, I think it's all integrated. How you live your life on, in every aspect is your legacy. And I always think about being a role model for my grandchildren particularly, that I make good choices. For me, legacy is about making good choices. And I think, Colin, it's in every arena of your life. Legacy is how you model your values and your values about your health, your nutrition, where you put your time, talent, and money. That's the story. That's the narrative of your life. So I agree with you. It's in every phase of this. And it's not one thing at a time. Life doesn't work that way. It's everything commingled. But every day making decisions about what's important. I was saying to you, Dory, earlier that I was watching an interview with Bill Moyers the other day, and I wrote down a quote about exploring the possibilities of life every day. How exciting it is to explore possibilities in every arena of our lives and to strengthen ourselves. And as David Brooks wrote in his book, The Road to Moral Character, and I love this quote, every day be the best version of yourself. It's not about anybody else. It's about you.
Right.
Do you like you? Are you the best version of who you can be? And if not, what do you need to tweak and change? But it's on every level, and I think it happens concurrently.
Yeah. Excellent point. I think you're absolutely right. So how did you end up deciding then to write your books? And tell us a little about that.
Well, I was married to an estate planning lawyer. This was a second marriage. And he said to me one day, the work that you do with youth, you should be doing with my clients. Taking values and putting them into action is for everyone. And at first I thought, okay, and I sort of put that idea in the back of my head, but I decided to write an ethical will. And I don't, you know, for your listeners, an ethical will is not a legal binding document, but it's a document that shares your values. I call it the narrative of your life. And yet I wanted, in my own words, to share who I was, what I cared about, what my values were, and particularly for family members and friends and loved ones, I wanted that to be in writing as something that I give as a gift to them. I want you to know Barbara, who she really was, what was her life about, what was important to her. And I started really writing this to my children and grandchildren and close friends. And one day Larry read this, and he said, this is really well done, but would you think of expanding this into a book, taking out the very personal stuff that you might not want to share with everyone? But he said, I think this is the beginning of a book. And so what I did was I took the very sensitive stuff that I wanted to share with my immediate family out, and then I started writing this book. And my resiliency was really tested when I was writing this book, because while I was writing the book, my mother, my father, and my husband died within the course of a couple of years while I was writing the book. And my husband said to me, be resilient, keep writing the book. No matter what happens with us, keep writing the book. And one of the things I wanted to share was that when life is very complicated and very difficult, looking outside of yourself for me has always been a blessing. I didn't want to feel victimized by the horror that I was confronting. They all died within 3 years. My husband and father actually died 2 months apart. And while I was in hospitals and in hospices, I had the manuscript with me, and in quiet moments, I kept writing the book, and it helped me stay sane in a very difficult time. And that was the genesis of the book. The sad part of the story is that none of the three of them ever saw the finished book. But they all inspired me in their own way to keep writing the book. And I remember my mother had dementia, and I was in New York with her for about a week, and she no longer spoke really, but I read her the book out loud, and I felt this was a really wonderful way to bond with her. She seemed to have a smile on her face. I didn't really know if she heard me, but there was something very special about reading the book out loud to her.
Well, the book is such an affirmation of them, too, and their legacy for you and your legacy to them and others. It's just very, very inspiring and impressive. So you've written two books, but one of them was, you know, with these 10 steps. I mean, are there other parts you want to share with people about?
Yeah, I would. What happened was I was speaking nationally. I'm doing mostly keynotes, and I was working for a bank that had me meet with high net worth clients, and the bank said to me one day, could you write a portfolio for us so that, you know, we could teach people how to have these conversations? For some people, it's very difficult to have what you call the below the neck conversations, opening up topics of legacy and values. So I wrote the second book, which I call The Portfolio, and I use that a lot when I'm running workshops. It could be a full-day workshop, half a day, sometimes even 2 days, where people really become introspective and reflect upon what is this all about for me, what are my values, what do I care about, and as I mentioned earlier, and do it in a multi-generational fashion with children, grandchildren, friends, people of different ages sitting and working this through together. And I've gotten a really good response to this because some of these questions people never really address. So the portfolio is something that I use when I go out and run the workshops.
So I don't think I've seen that book, so I'm going to have to go ahead.
No,
The
first book is available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. The second book I have myself, and I use it as a teaching tool, and I bring it with me when I run workshops.
Is it available for people to purchase?
It could be. The other one is much easier. They can get it on Amazon. I bring the second one when I run a workshop.
When you do. Okay. Well, no, that's helpful for people to know. And what can you tell people a little about the handout that you have, the legacy profile?
Yes. So if they can focus on the handout, I call it my legacy profile. When I do a workshop, I have people spend time looking at what is their interest? What is their salsa? What are things that they love to do? And then causes. What are issues, either locally or nationally or globally, that resonate for them? And then under skills. We all have lots of skills, but maybe we don't want to use all of them. For instance, the accountant who says, I'd rather do desktop publishing and public speaking than always working with numbers. Or for myself, I know how to write grants, but I really choose not to want to do that. So what are the skills that I want to use at this stage of my life? And what are the resources that are available to me in terms of people resources, money resources, venues, if I wanted to create a project? And what are some of the ideas? This was actually the worksheet that I used when I came back from my trip to Auschwitz, because I knew I wanted to do something with this experience, but I wasn't clear. Did I want to do it in school systems? Did I want to do it in after-school programs? Did I want to train teachers? How did I want to put it together? And by using this approach, I ratcheted it down until I created the mission statement for Champions of Caring. So I wanted to just share this profile so people today can start thinking of, what is their salsa? What do they love? Mm-hmm. What's an issue that they care about? How can they begin to break it into small parts, pull people around them that would be interested in being supportive to the project, and create a legacy profile? And this is the kind of work that I do with groups when I come into communities.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And I know you wanted to let people know that you really are interested in being invited to be able to do that.
Oh, absolutely. The joy of my life right now professionally is coming in to either do keynotes or to do these kinds of workshops. And I like to be creative about it. When a client says to me, would you do children and grandparents, or would you want to do mothers and daughters, or fathers and sons? That all excites me, because I think being creative and looking at the needs of the client is very, very important, so that you're bringing something that has value to a community. So, yes, if any of you are interested in my work and bringing me to your communities, I'd be delighted to speak with you. And please go on the website, embraceyourlegacynow.com, to see the kinds of speeches I give, where I've given speeches. I also have a YouTube channel, Barbara Shaman. You can hear me speak. And I would love you to reach out to me. This has been such a pleasure, Dori, to spend time with you and share my passion, my vision, and interests with your audience. And I'm always open to learn and collaborate, because together we can really change the world in very powerful ways.
Oh, you're so right. And I hope that this message gets out to more and more people. But, I mean, it's so true, living with the kindness rather than the hate. I like to think of where hate give love. I do want to, I know some people may have already needed to leave, but I think Pat, who started out the questions of, you know, getting past, you know, her lack of confidence and fear, I've decided she's going to get the book.
So, my pleasure. And Pat, if you're on, okay. I'm happy to sign the book and send it to you. If you can give us your contact information, yeah. I hope you enjoy reading it. And please reach out to me if you have any questions.
Great. So, Pat, send me an email, dorian@dorianmincer.com, and with your address, and I will get that information to Barbara. So I don't have other questions from anyone else. There is a comment from Elizabeth, to make sure. Elizabeth from Minneapolis, who, do you know Kate Schaefer's?
No.
She's involved in LPN. Okay, Elizabeth just said, and I can make that introduction to introduce you to Kate, because I guess Kate has a new initiative at University of Minnesota. And so I'll connect the two of you so that you
Wonderful.
Can maybe be in touch of what she's doing. So you had mentioned about, I think you have mentioned about the loving to do the intergenerational work and the working with children. I think at one point you said there were some other things you might wanted to add about working with children. I just want to give you the opportunity if there was something else you wanted to say about that.
Well, I just think that, you know, children are our future, and it's very important to start sharing these values with young children. And you do share it by doing, not just by talking. Sometimes we think if we say it over and over again, it will resonate. Take them with you. Include them in the decision making. I remember one year having a family discussion, and my granddaughter was about 7 at the time. And I started with, what do you love and what do you want to do? And my granddaughter says, I don't want anyone in the whole universe ever to be hungry. And her brother started laughing and said something like, you can't do the whole universe, because sometimes kids come up with these huge ideas. So when you're working with youth, help them ratchet it down so you can have success. I've had this in Champions of Caring as well, where they want to solve world hunger, and then they decided they could do a community garden in their neighborhood because there weren't fruits or vegetables available in the community where they lived. Mm-hmm. So just being more realistic with youth, because sometimes when kids get frustrated, like adults, they throw out everything, and you want to keep them excited and energized. So sometimes you have to take a small chunk and start with that, and then you can grow it as you have more and more success. But don't let the project overwhelm the person, and this is at any stage of life. If you see it's too much, cut it down. Have little successes, and then you build on those successes. I think that's very key.
That's a very important point. It's true. Success begets more success. Mastery begets more mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And breaking it into meaningful little small parts. So this has just been so wonderful and rich. I'm just so delighted that you've been able to be here and share this, your story, your wisdom, your legacy, and helping people really think about, you know, the fact that every day we really are living our legacy. We just need to be conscious and intentional about it, and to think about what else we can do, you know, and to live each day off abilities. I truly subscribe to that. Any final kind of comments, takeaways you'd like the audience
to
have?
I'll share one story about my mother, which I loved. When I was a little girl, my mother did the Mensch test with us. The Mensch test was a test that every day, you know, a Mensch is a German Jewish word that means good person. And when I was 7 years old, I would come back from school and my mother would say to me, "Were you a Mensch today?" And I remember sitting on the bus coming home from school, creating and fabricating these issues like I was Superwoman, that I saved a whole city, that I put out fires. And I'd come in to tell her this elaborate tale, and she'd say to me, "I can smell a lie. Stop right there." And she said to me, "Look, every day you have a responsibility in this world to do a good thing. And think about it. And when you go to sleep, don't count sheep. Count ways of what you did that was nice today, from the smallest thing to the largest thing you could do, and then think about tomorrow how you can be a mensch again." And when I was young, I sort of resented this because it was like, oh my God, what am I going to tell my mother? And should I make it up? Should I, you know, how do I do this? But I think it's very good advice, and I use it as a reflective tool when I go to bed, reflecting on, could I have been nicer to someone today? Could I have reached out more? Because it's really about living within your soul. Do you like yourself? Are you happy with what's going on? So in honor of my mother and in her memory, I would like to end with, be the mensch today. And think about it, not just randomly, but with intention. Mm-hmm. How can I be more of a mensch, from not slamming a door in someone's face to reaching out to a friend who has a problem to serving on a committee to address an important issue, so that we can create a world where there are more people who act like a mensch, so that we have a better future for ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, and future generations.
What wonderful wisdom. That's just beautiful. I mean, you're just making my heart very warm with this notion of the mensch test. So thank you so much again for being with us and sharing just these wonderful pearls of wisdom and your example of how you've been living your legacy and how you've helped other people do it. And again, keep in mind, as Barbara said, that she's available if, you know, people want to bring her to your communities to do workshops or presentations. And her book is available through Amazon. And when you get the recording, you'll see on the event page the handout is there, so that you can download that and sort of begin to fill out your legacy profile. And thank you. This was just wonderful, Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy.
Thank you, everybody, for being part of this. Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody. So remember, the fourth Tuesday of each month. Hope to see you next month.